On November 10th, 1975, the SS Edmund Fitzgerald sank in Lake Superior. All 29 crew members died. At that time, it was the worst shipping disaster on the Great Lakes in 11 years. Other shipping disasters followed along the line. But in that case, that was the worst ever. On November 11th, 1913, 18 ships were lost, killing 254 people. On November 11th, 1940, 57 men died when three freighters sank in Lake Michigan. On November 18th, 1958, 33 men died on Lake Michigan. On November 29th, 1966, the Daniel J. Morrill sank in Lake Huron, killing 28 crew members. The Great Lakes are indeed treacherous. In November. In a moment, our guest Mark Gumbinger, we're going to talk about the Edmund Fitzgerald. Mark Gumbinger is a maritime historian and a shipwreck expert. He has produced 30 critically acclaimed shipwreck and lighthouse programs nationwide, including 5 on the Edmund Fitzgerald, 1 on the Andrea Doria. He has been researching shipwrecks and lighthouses for more than 25 years. Mark, every time I hear that Gordon Lightfoot song, it just chills me. You too?
Oh, yeah, definitely, George. It's very eerie.
You know, I was a 25-year-old producer in Detroit, Michigan at the time when we started getting very strange phone calls from people up there in Michigan saying that they think a ship had sank. And, you know, that was the first time we had ever heard of a ship sinking. And we called our news director at the time, and he said, well, it's way too far for us to go up there. It's going to cost too much money. And so after we hung up the phone with him, and I could have been fired for this, I sent a crew up there to Lake Superior. And,
Good for you.
And we're down there in Detroit. And we were the only crew to get any film footage of some of the remains of what was in the Edmund Fitzgerald, you know, like life preservers and things that had floated to the top.
The flotsam, sure.
Absolutely. And that video we got to, it was film at the time, we got it over to CBS News. They had it on their news in 1975, which was probably Walter Cronkite.
You were the CBS affiliate,
yep,
TV station?
WJBK.
How neat is that?
At the time. Now it's a Fox station. And gosh, I remember that story just so vividly. But still the controversy, Mark, over what happened on that day with that ship. Let's go back a little bit. Tell us just about the Edmund Fitzgerald, way before the sinking occurred.
Well, it was built in 1958. A Milwaukee insurance company decided to build the ship. It was the largest ship at the time. It was at her launching. She was built in Michigan. She was 729 feet long, approximately 75 feet wide. She carried mostly taconite iron ore for the automotive business. The night the Fitzgerald sank, she was carrying enough to enough iron ore to build 7,500 automobiles.
Oh my God!
Over 26,000 tons, George, and it was literally the flagship of her fleet. It was a ship that you wanted to sail on. The captain sailed for 44 years. He was one of the youngest masters ever to sail on the Great Lakes since like 1950, and before that he sailed on the ocean. So that you really couldn't think of a better ship or captain and crew to for a ship that you'd want to sail on. This was just a beautiful, majestic. It was nicknamed the Queen of the Lakes, and now of course they coin it the Titanic of the Great Lakes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just unbelievable that in 1975 you could have this thoroughly modern freighter literally in a blip of a radar screen disappear. Some experts think in as little as 10 seconds, George, the ship vanished from the radar and plunged, and she now lies in two pieces in the bottom of Lake Superior in 520 feet of frigid water.
Oh, gosh. You know, the song by Lightfoot, of course, talks about the Indian legend of Lake Superior. That obviously must have taken a lot of Native Americans in those days as well, as maybe they tried to canoe their way across the lake. What do we know about Lake Superior, Mark?
Well, it's the deepest and arguably the most treacherous of the Great Lakes. The Great Lakes have a horrible statistic that per their body of water, per square mile, there's more shipwrecks on the Great Lakes than any other body of water in the world. There's I've heard anywhere from 6,000 to 10,000 documented shipwrecks on the Great Lakes alone. And Lake Superior, it's the longest. It's almost 400 miles from corner to corner. And it has a chop that'll just beat you to death, George, where like out on the ocean, you have a more of a swale and you could have higher waves, but you have more of a distance in between those waves.
Right. It's almost like music. You know, it's got some kind of symmetry to it.
Absolutely. And the distance between the waves on the Great Lakes and especially Lake Superior has a chop and it just beats your ship to death.
Well, the lake itself, when they talk about the winds of November, what do they mean by that?
The winds or the gales of November, what happens a lot of times, especially in November, and if you look at a lot of those other ships that you talked about, sank in November. And that's the water is still warm from the summer. A lot of times the core temperature in the air is freezing or a little above or a little below. A lot of times, in this case, the night the Fitzgerald sank, had as much as 100 mile an hour per winds and up to 35 foot waves, averaging right around the time the Fitzgerald sank anywhere from 16 to 20 feet and about 63 knots. So it wasn't a good night to be out on the lake.
On that night, specifically with those weather conditions, what was going on then?
Well, the Fitzgerald proceeded eastbound. She was loaded the morning before, November 9th, 1975, with a little over 26,000 tons of iron ore. So,
and she was leaving from Superior, Wisconsin, right?
That's correct, okay. The western end of Lake Superior. So Gordon Lightfoot definitely had his lyrics were correct on that. And she proceeded north. By two harbors, not far from the majestic Split Rock Lighthouse, and came in the company of another ship called the Arthur M. Anderson. So those two ships, pretty much in tandem, went north and then ventured east to take the eastern shipping route. They were going to go through the Sioux Locks, and the Fitzgerald's final destination for that was Detroit to bring in the iron ore. And the Fitzgerald was a faster ship than the Arthur M. Anderson, so the Anderson ended up anywhere from 10 to 20 miles behind the Fitzgerald. But they kept in contact first visually and then by radar. As they continued east the next day, November 10th, in the afternoon, the storm worsened. Originally, the weather report was supposed to be a typical November storm. Well, they really underestimated how typical it was because they were way off on the wave height and the winds. Oh. And literally, as I said earlier, freshwater hurricane centered itself over Marquette and virtually right over. The Fitzgerald ended up really couldn't have been at a worse time in a worse place, George. It was just boom, right where you didn't want to
sure.
be.
And these were gale force winds, right, Mark?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, you know, the captain, Bernie Cooper, he testified that they were averaging about 63 knots and at times with gusts of over 100. So, and then with the wave height of averaging around 20 feet, but Captain Bernie Cooper later documented that he saw some that were 30 to 35 feet. He thought one of those might have actually caught the Fitzgerald in a mountain of water and caused her demise.
Were the captains of the Anderson and the Fitzgerald chit-chatting at all with each other?
Yes, they were keeping in touch, and if not by both of them, by the captain or the third mate of the Anderson, who was ever in the pilot house at the time, but they were keeping in constant communication. And as the Fitzgerald continued east, George, the Fitzgerald lost both of her use of her radar. They don't know exactly when it went out.
Oh, my. Everything went wrong.
Yeah, and the Fitzgerald, even though it was a thoroughly modern freighter, it did not have a depth finder. It didn't have any way of measuring if water was coming into the cargo hold. So, you know, it was just a lot of things that you think you'd have in 1975 weren't available to the Fitzgerald. And, you know, looking back at it now, you think, geez, you know, they could have had, for $100, they could have had some electronics that would have really helped them out. And you have to also remember, George, this is before GPS, global positioning.
Right.
And so they didn't have that. And also, the one night when that lighthouse was probably needed most by Whitefish Point, the power went out and the backup generator didn't go on and the radio beacon wasn't working. And that could have really helped navigate the Fitzgerald to decide if it should have gone more left or right by a caribou island that has a shoal, which is a six-fathom shoal, which is about approximately 36 feet below the lake's surface. And a lot of experts, and we'll get into the theories a little bit later, thought that maybe that could have contributed to the demise. The Fitzgerald could have grounded on that shoal, taken on water below her water line, or below her opened up some of her plates, and her pumps couldn't have kept up and caused her to finally lose her battle, you know, in the teeth of a 35-foot wave on Lake Superior that fateful November 10th night.
When a ship like the Fitzgerald is caught in rough weather, there's not much you can do, right? I mean, can you go faster to try to escape? What do you do?
The captain, Captain Ernest McSorley, the Fitzgerald, was talking with the Anderson. I believe it was the third mate at that time. And they decided that they were going to take the northerly route, and this is something the captains did from the turn of the century in rough weather. They'd get the lee from the Canadian shoreline. Even though it was a longer trip, at least it'd be less severe weather, theoretically, until you make that turn more east, southeast.
Okay, so he'd go up and then he'd pull over.
Right, and so that helps to a certain extent. What the Fitzgerald was doing after they were reporting a list, and that once her fence rail was down and both of her radar units were out, he had communication that he was going to check his ship down, meaning he was going to slow it down to shorten the distance between the Anderson, which was, I think, at one point as far as 20 miles behind the Fitzgerald. I know when the Fitzgerald did lose the blip on the Anderson's radar screen, she was down to 9 miles. So the captain probably didn't think he was going to lose his ship, but he did have the inkling that maybe he should close the gap between the two ships just in case.
How close were the two ships to each other, the Fitzgerald and the Anderson?
In how far they were from each other?
Yeah.
Size?
In terms of just the space between each other?
At the end, approximately 9 miles.
9 miles.
There. Yeah, the Anderson was behind the Fitzgerald giving radar coordinates, and it was just horrible. You can only imagine to be out in those seas and then not to have your radar and not to have a depth finder, not to know if there's water in your cargo hold. And she was carrying these tactinite iron ore pellets, and that's also a material that can absorb a lot of weight in water and moisture. And some experts think as much as 2 tons of water could be absorbed in this tactinite iron ore, which didn't help any and which would make you sit lower and lower. Also, George, back in the late 60s and early 70s, 3 times, I think 69 and twice in the early 70s, they raised the limit of how much cargo. They were more lenient, more liberal, let them carry more cargo.
Less trips, more cargo, right?
Exactly. Unfortunately, that would make you sit lower in the water and be much more too prone of water coming over the ship's spar deck and over the hatch covers. And it could allow much more water flooding into the ship's hold as well and less freeboard.
Mark, once a ship starts to lean to one side, and that was happening with the Fitzgerald, does it automatically, you know, ballast back or does it just keep going?
Well, what they can do is put more water. Let's say if it has a starboard list, it's leaning to the right, they could put more water into the port or left side of the ship to help balance it out, but now that's going to contribute you to sitting even lower in the water.
Right.
The ship will actually handle better because it's more
balanced, right?
More balanced and more weight, but now you're sitting even lower. So now what was happening, they kept sitting lower in the water, and the waves and wind kept going higher and up in speed, and the wind was just pelting the Fitzgerald like crazy that night.
Okay, they're 9 miles apart from each other, which in that kind of weather is probably more like 90 miles apart in terms of just trying to get to you.
Might as well have been. Well, yeah, I mean, I think the ship's I don't know what they were doing against the wind that night, and the wind kept shifting from a southerly to a northerly direction. You never knew where the wind was coming because it kept changing at you. So at least probably approximately an hour. And actually, if you would have ended up in that water, I don't know exactly what the water temperature was. I want to say it was maybe in the 50 degree, give or take a couple degrees. But in one of my interviews with the base commander from the Coast Guard, he thought that hypothermia could kick in any time, like between 20 minutes and 40 minutes. So even if you ended up in the water, and if the ship was lucky enough to find you and then get you out of there, it's almost too late. And even in 1975, they didn't have survival suits. Not that any of this would have helped the Fitzgerald, because the Fitzgerald sank so rapidly, they wouldn't have even had time to put any of this on. And the way the lifeboats were positioned, they were very hard to get off, and they didn't either. They did have two rafts, but it wasn't an easy task to get to. And again, at the rapid descent of the Fitzgerald, it wasn't like a slow sinker like, you know, you watch the old Titanic movies.
Yeah, it takes forever.
It takes several hours. Even the Andrea Doria that we can maybe talk about later, that was afloat for about like 6 hours, 7 hours, where the Fitzgerald was a matter of seconds before she, made a rapid descent to the bottom of Lake Superior.
Why didn't anything happen to the Anderson? I mean, it's out there in the same seas.
Well, one could argue that the Anderson didn't have structural damage to her, and she also, with her radar units working, the captain was very cognizant of that six-fathom shoal north of Caribou Island, and he stayed far away from it. Ironically, after they did some documentation, they had an old Canadian chart, and when they went out and checked for that shoal again, there was actually about another mile's worth of shoal north and east of what that was originally documented on the charts. So even in 1975, they didn't even have accurate charting of where these shoals were located. But the Anderson was very, very aware of those shoals, and he stayed farther away from them. And he even testified the night the Fitzgerald sank, when he was talking to the base commander of the Coast Guard and on record to the Marine Board of Investigation, that he thought the Fitzgerald ship was a heck of a lot closer than he wanted his own ship to be.
How many hatchways did the Fitzgerald have?
It had 21. These are massive hatch covers. I think they're the Fitzgerald 75 feet wide. I believe the size were like 11 by 18, and 21 hatch covers. And these are mammoth, and they had battened down. I think there was 64 latches, sort of like an old suitcase would. You would snap down. Then you take
and you buckle it over or something.
Exactly, and then you take a mammoth wrench and you tighten it, and you have to manually do all of these. And when the Coast Guard, when they checked the sister ships of the Fitzgerald, they came to the conclusion that the Fitzgerald had faulty hatch cover gaskets. And if there was a little bit of a gap in there, their estimates were thousands of gallons of water a minute could come into the ship's hold, and the Fitzgerald couldn't keep up with her. Hence lost buoyancy and sank.
That could have been the big reason then.
That's one of the, that's pretty much what the Marine Board of Investigation stamped and signed off on, that they thought it had faulty hatch cover gaskets.
Any negligence here, Mark, in your opinion?
The captain was, none was given to the captain. The captain was a 44-year-old veteran. They did. Some ex-crew members advanced the fact that the Fitzgerald's hull needed to be welded and possibly the keel wasn't as sound as it should have been, but the Coast Guard signed off on it. I know there was a quote that Captain McSorley made to one of his crew members, "I don't care, I just need one more year out of this ship and I'm done."
Oh, yeah.
But I mean, as far as when they left, I know one of the Coast Guard members on the board thought that if they didn't properly tighten down those hatches and manually go over every one of those 64 hatch cover housings, that it could have left enough of a gap that would have allowed sufficient water to come in. And the fact that it wasn't a good seal to begin with when they checked the sister ships.
Mark, when we come back, let's talk about the crew. Tell me what you think they were doing on that fateful night, November 10th, 1975. Well, take advantage of the short time. The After Dark double CD will be offered to you for the holidays, so you can buy it as a present, those of you who have friends and neighbors who love to listen to Coast to Coast. A double CD with bumper music, phone calls to the program, and some ghost stories. You can call 1-800-598-2331. That's 1-800-598-2331. You can go to their website, which is afterdarkcd.com. This will not be available any longer after the holidays. This will be it. You know, we had it out there about a year ago and then wanted to bring it back just for a month and a half for the holidays. So 1-800-598-2331 or afterdarkcd.com. All right, we're back with Mark Gumbinger as we talk about the Edmund Fitzgerald. Next hour, we're going to talk about the Andrea Doria and haunted lighthouses. And Mark, before we get into the Edmund Fitzgerald, on that day, November 11, 1913, 18 ships lost, killing 254 people. What the heck was going on that day?
That was the storm of 1913, and man, that wasn't a good one. That wiped out, I think, more ships in the Great Lakes than any other storm did, and ships and loss of life. It was just a horrible storm. A very similar type of weather conditions that went through that took the Fitzgerald out. Obviously, too, like 1966 was the Daniel J. Morrell broken two on Lake Huron, and in 1958 you have the Carl Bradley that also broke in two. A lot of people thought the Edmund Fitzgerald might have broken too, but the Bradley and the Morrell were sort of built more in the early 1900s, like the Titanic time, and also had sort of a brittle steel that sort of became brittle in the cold water, sort of like the analogy, George, when you take a credit card and you bend it back and forth and it finally breaks, and that's what happened with those ships. But the Fitzgerald was a thoroughly modern freighter. It was built in 1958, post-World War II. And she was said to have the more modern, more flexible steel, unlike the older vessels.
Only 17 years old then when it went down.
Exactly.
And to some people, if you just want to get a perspective of how long the Fitzgerald was, bigger than two football fields side by side.
Isn't that hard to imagine?
I mean,
and you know what it's like, living on the Great Lakes. And if you probably went down by Detroit there and over there by Belle Isle, and you see these freighters coming through, and it's just unimaginable that a ship the size of Fitzgerald, which was the largest ship at the time to sail when she was launched in 1958, held numerous tonnage records, actually broke her own tonnage records year after year. And again, that's part of the problem, because they letting her have more tonnage than she was originally designed for in 1958. 3 years there, from like 1969, I think it was 71 and 72, they kept upping her, load. And it just, one could argue that it might have been a little too much for
her. The ship with the people aboard, 29 people died. Not a particularly big crew for a ship that big, or do you need a lot of people?
That's about right. I know the Bradley and the Morrell, I think, had a few more souls on board. I think the Bradley might have been around 32, and the Morrell right in the low 30s also. The Fitzgerald, being that it was a little bit more modern, that was about right. Usually around 30 people. I'm sure as the storms continued, they were rocking and rolling, and they were doing their duties as professional seamen, and they were, doing what they had to do. I know some crewmen said, if the ship would ever sink, you'd almost don't even want to end up in the water. You just sort of curl yourself up in a fetal position in your bunk and pull your wool blankets over your head and pray, because you just don't want to be in that water.
That's the next question, Mark. If you can, without being too graphic here, hypothesize on just what happened and what it was like for the crew, where they might have been, because it was dark outside.
Yeah, it was shortly after 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, and the sun probably set good 2 hours before that.
Yes.
And then there was inclement weather. Besides, at one point of 100-plus mile-an-hour winds, 35-foot waves, you also had, there was a snow squall in there also.
I mean, my God.
It's just horrible. And you can only imagine not having a depth finder. The only depth finder they had was a rope that had like a 14-pound lead instrument on the end.
And they just lowered it?
With knots. You go out to the bow in the front of the ship, and that's what you would do. You'd lower it. And that was pretty much only used in good weather when you were like in harbor. So, I mean, you're out there trucking along. That was the only depth finder for 1975. That's, you know, you just couldn't imagine that they wouldn't have some better, you know, better fathom reader than they had than a piece of rope with lead on the end of it.
Are they, the hatches are leaking. The ship is listing. It's leaning. In the crew, the 29 crew members, were they at this time?
They were all, I'm sure, doing their duties. There was probably some that were in their bunks, you know, off. You had the chef trying to, I don't know how you can try to cook in that kind of condition with the rock and rolling of the ship.
Now, was everything in terms of their sleep quarters, the kitchen, in places where they lived, was that below deck or above deck? In a higher structure, or was everything below deck?
It was varied. It was depending on, you know, where you were. You know, obviously, if you were in the front of the ship, you were dealing more with the pilot house, and that was...
So you're way up there.
That was up there. Unfortunately, when she sank, literally at Captain Ernest McSorley, the captain of the Fitzgerald, literally at arm's length, he had a ship-to-shore wireless radio. He did not have time to summon an SOS. That's how fast the ship sank, George. Some experts think in as little as 10 seconds she took her initial plunge, lost her freeboard, and hit a mountain of water and never recovered.
And just boom, 10 seconds, it's gone.
Boom, gone. And now the people in the back of the ship, the stern, they might have had a little bit more time to consciously realize what was happening, but the poor crew members, including the captain up in the pilot house, they hit a wall of water, and they were probably pushed down into the ship's hold and fortunately didn't know what hit them. I mean, it was fast enough where they couldn't get an SOS off, so that just tells you how fast it was.
Did they ever recover any of these 29 crew members, or did everybody go down with the ship?
Pretty much it's considered that everybody is entombed in the ship or laying right by it. There was one expedition in the early 90s. They thought they found the remains of a crew member, but they couldn't positively identify it, and it's possible that it could have even been from another lost ship back in like 1913. They can't conclusively identify that, but most opinion, it's treated like an underwater grave, as it should be, out of the respect for the family and the lost souls on board. But most of the plausible theories is that they are entombed in the ship and they really didn't know what hit them. Possibly in the stern, they might have had seconds or maybe a minute or two, but I would imagine they were probably knocked unconscious. And not to be morbid, I heard one engineer and a medical examiner thought that at that thrust and depth at 520 feet below the surface, the bodies could have imploded. That just due to that so much force of the stress of being that deep under the water, and at the rapid rate of her descent,
and they would have been dead by then anyway, don't you think?
So the only good thing is they certainly didn't suffer long.
No,
and definitely in the pilot house they hardly suffered at all.
Those of us who are alive think of it as more of a tragic, horrible death, and probably it was in terms of how they died. It was fast.
And thank God for that. I mean, absolutely, George. Because that's one of the few good things about the mystery, and that's what we're always going to have. Because we'll never know conclusively, because the bow is now in about 24 feet of the lake's floor in mud. The stern is in an upside down or an inverted position, approximately 180 feet away on a slight angle from the bow. And then you have this midsection, which is about 180 feet, which is just a big debris field. And so you can look in the back of the stern, but you can't find anything conclusively if she would have bottomed out. And where she could have bottomed out was in the middle or in the bow, and you'll never be able to tell because the bow is sitting in 24 feet of the lake's floor.
Because I've heard a couple theories, Mark, that in one that she was just pulled up and then dropped down and snapped in two and went down that way, Or then the other theory was, of course, that it split apart after it hit the bottom. What do you think? What do you believe?
Well, you know, I've done a lot of research on this, and you can't conclusively say one or the other. You know, you read the information what the Coast Guard presented. They probably did the most exhausting, research on everything, and they were down there with cameras and videotape. And their theory was that it had the faulty hatch cover gaskets. Then you look at the Lake Carriers report and others, and as Captain Bernie Cooper, who the captain of the Anderson was at the point 9 miles behind the Fitzgerald, him and the third mate were plotting the chart and where the Fitzgerald was, and he really thought that she touched on a shoal there north of Caribou Island. And then when they went back and checked where that the shoal area was, and they found that they had an old faulty chart that misrepresented where that shoal line could have been, that there was like another mile worth of shoal that you could have touched on anywhere from 10 to 36 feet. And the Fitzgerald sat in the water. It had about 27.2-foot draft,
mm-hmm.
and the back was a couple inches different, but basically a little over 27 feet. So if you're rocking in that water, it's very probable that she could have touched on this shoal, a 6-fathom shoal, which was each shoal is six feet, so it's 36 feet below the lake surface, and she could have run aground and opened up her plates below the water line and started taking in water and not even knowing
it. They didn't even know.
And then you have, George, the Fitzgerald had a center drain, and you have this water seeping into this taconite iron ore, which can absorb water, and it takes so long for it to go from the center drain to the aft of the ship, which they call a rose box, that would pump the water out. So, a lot of other ships had a starboard or a port drainage system where the Fitzgerald had a center drain, and it wasn't the most efficient way of trying to get rid of the water. The other thing is the Fitzgerald basically was open in the middle. It didn't have any bulkheads that separated any of the cargo or water. So once the water got in there, it sort of got in there and it went through the entire ship. And you would think as a result of that they would do a lot of things and start putting bulkheads in these ships for safety reasons. You might get a little less cargo in there, but for the safety of the crew, it'd be a marvelous improvement.
The search and rescue teams must have been in shock when they were trying to scurry and look for this and realize this thing was gone.
There were a lot of problems with that, George. The captain, McSorley, he wired the Coast Guard. He didn't wire him. He called in on the ship-to-shore radio. And they were having problems with communication, and they had to change from one channel to another on the VHF channel. And there was confusion that took about a half an hour to communicate. By that time, it was already like an hour and a half after
it was gone.
And pretty much, if hypothermia would have kicked in, let's say from 20 minutes to an hour, the only possible salvation of anybody to find anybody would have been the Anderson herself. And as a tribute, which we should say here, the Anderson, Captain Bernie Cooper, turned the ship around with his crew and risked capsizing in those seas and went out and looked for 2 days for any possible
survivors.
But now you have to remember the Anderson was another big ship, approximately 700 feet, I think it was 760 feet long, very similar size to the Fitz. Turned around, and how do you, you're up 30, 40 feet. How can you, and you're rolling waves of, 20 to 35 foot waves and 100 mile an hour winds. The wind started to abate after the Fitz did sink.
Yeah. Luckily enough.
How could you, if you even found a survivor, how could you pluck one out of the water? The only Coast Guard cutter that was in active duty was on a several-hour standby, and that was back on the western end of Lake Superior in Duluth, which was 320 miles away from the accident site. And that took a whole, 24 hours for them to show up. But, by that time, everybody, if anybody was fortunate enough or unfortunate enough to get off, they wouldn't have survived that long in that kind of water or sea.
Mark, how old were these 29 crew members? Where were they from?
They were from mostly all over the Great Lakes. They varied in age from early 20s to 60s. Pretty much most people were Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio. The captain lived in Toledo, Ohio. Unfortunately, George, this was not only going to be the captain's final journey, but he was going to retire after that. This was the last trip of the season for him.
Oh, my.
He just wrote his wife. His wife was ill. She lived in a nursing home. She had suffered from polio. And he wrote her after 44 years of service, and he just wrote her a note saying, "It won't be long now. I'll be home. Everything will be fine." And, you know, literally so close yet so far. She was only about 17 miles away from from the entrance of Whitefish Harbor. And here she went the entire length of Lake Superior and 17 miles short, and now lies in the bottom of Lake Superior in 520 feet of water and two, actually technically three pieces.
Were the families taken care of with insurance, do you know?
Somewhat, and they sued, but you could look at it as pretty paltry by today's standards,
yeah,
but we
absolutely
don't get into that too much. But
you know, 1958, there was sinking of the Bradley, and 1966, 8 years later, the Daniel Morrell sank. 75, 9 years later, the Edmund Fitzgerald, and then nothing. So what has happened? Have ships gotten better?
I think a lot of it is just sheer luck. And,
or is the weather abated?
Well, you do have the weather forecasts. I would like to think that ships have better electronics with GPS and with depth finders. If the Fitzgerald had GPS today, she might have been able to make that right decision and steered a couple more miles around Caribou Island and missed that shoal if she indeed did ground on that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's so many, you know, different things that play into it. And now they do have more survival suits and better life support rafts than they did back in 1975. But the fact that how the Whitefish Point lighthouse went dark, the radio beacon wasn't working, the backup generator never went on. About 3 years before that, they went automated, and there was no live person to make sure those lights were on and the radio beacon was working. That could have, in itself, gave the coordinates to the Fitzgerald to help them maybe steer around that shoal. And then the fact that you had this outdated chart that didn't even properly show these underwater shoals, literally an underwater rock to come up and bite your ship.
There's, of course, another disaster I want to talk with you about next hour, and that is the Andrea Doria. And, you know, these tragedies and attempted rescues at seas are tremendous stories. So we'll talk about that, Mark, and also some haunted lighthouse questions as well. You've been doing this for a long time, huh?
I've been a full-time researcher and documentarian, owner of our website, EdmundFitzgerald.com, for, Southport Video Productions has been in business for over 15 years.
Why interested in shipwrecks?
My late father, he used to fill me with stories about ships that sank. We had a ship off of Kenosha, Wisconsin. The SS Wisconsin sank in 1929, the same day as the stock market crash. He used to tell me stories about that. He was also a fireman, and he used to watch TV when they weren't putting fires out, and he saw the wonderful, I shouldn't say wonderful, but the spectacular 1956 footage of the Andrea Doria sinking off of Long Island near Nantucket. And he used to always tell me with stories on that. Well, we've produced programs on that and the Andrea Doria, and as well as many other shipwrecks in the Great Lakes, and, of course, later in the program, haunted lighthouses.
It was a collision between the Andrea Doria and what was the other one, the Stockholm?
Stockholm, sure.
That was in 1956. So we'll talk about that case, and then we'll get into haunted lighthouses next on Coast to Coast AM.